You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
And welcome to Connect the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here on this glorious Friday afternoon. It's really glorious here in Seattle today. It's just been raining cats and dogs all week, but all of a sudden the sun came out and it's beautiful and sunny and rather pleasant. And so I'm happy. We're here on this Friday afternoon with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. Hiya, Steve. How's it going?
It's going well. I've got movies I'm excited to talk about, and that always means it's going well.
Yes. Well, that's good. It's it seems to be shaping up after a kind of a dreary summer for movies. We're getting some good ones all of a sudden. I'm really looking forward to a number of movies, and I'm particularly excited to be talking about some of the films we're talking about today. So what's happening out there in Bijou land?
You know, you always say that, and I wonder – are bijous things that you have in Seattle? Do those really exist, or is this something?
Oh, bijou is a name for a theater.
Yeah, I know, but in my mind, it's like Acme and the Coyote on the Roadrunner cartoon. It's like a theoretical thing. I've never actually seen a bijou theater.
Well, you know, I don't think I have either. When I hear bijou, the theater that I think that John Dillinger was walking out of when he got gunned down by the G-Men, Melvin Purvis, was a Bijou, although I could be wrong. It might be, now that I think about it, it might have been called the Biograph Theater. I think it was in Chicago. Why do I know that, you ask? I don't even know. It's just one of those things that's like filed away in my mind for some reason, and I don't know why that is. So, so there you go. Bijous. It's a word I use now and then.
Yes, you do. There are two movies opening at theaters this weekend, and we talked about one of them on last week's show. I wouldn't be surprised if it came up again on this week's show. We're going to be focusing mostly on the other one, and they are movies that have some things in common and some things not in common.
Okay.
Hacksaw Ridge and Doctor Strange are both big films that lots of people are going to be interested in seeing, and they were both directed by Christians.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is a Catholic, Mel Gibson, bad Catholic. Other one is by a Protestant, good Protestant, Scott Derrickson. And both films deal in different ways with faith themes. So we're going to do some connecting of dots on this show because that's what we do, right?
That is a fantastic idea. Well, I just hope that you're going to deal with, I think, the really penetrating analysis of Doctor Strange that's been offered by Dr. Ted Baer.
Such an
important and insightful. For diversion for a second, we'll get back to talking about Ted Baer, but this reminds me, one time I was driving around Seattle, this is a few years back when Avatar came out, and our mutual friend Jeffrey Overstreet, who is also a film critic, an evangelical guy, he lives here in Seattle, he's at Seattle Pacific University. I'm driving around, and I turn on the radio, and there's poor Jeffrey Overstreet getting interviewed by somebody local, because here in Seattle, Seattle was ground zero of Mars Hill Church, pastored at the time by Mark Driscoll, who a lot of Catholics may not be familiar with, but he was a huge noise in evangelical circles. And Mark Driscoll had declared Avatar, of all things, the James Cameron film, to be the most satanic film ever made. And poor Jeffrey was on this radio show forced into the position of defending Avatar and saying, you know, and he says, I feel like I'm having to defend the value of a Happy Meal. I don't even want to be here doing this, but I, you know, just in justice, I have to say that that's the stupidest thing you can say about Avatar.
All of the legitimate criticisms you could bring against Avatar, which is, for what it's worth, a film that I enjoyed tremendously.
I did too. That was fun, you know.
But it does have very glaring weaknesses and problems.
Sure.
And, you know, you can go after it for its kind of new agey spirituality.
Right.
But
it's like swatting a fly with a bazooka. I mean,
yeah. I mean, the only reason that anyone would call it, and this is a phenomenon that we've talked about in the past, and I think, you know, this is something that's maybe worth paying a little bit more attention than we normally do. Movies and books and other cultural phenomena tend to become subjected to overwrought hyperbole based sheerly on popular. So if right. Avatar hadn't been the most money-making movie in history, if Avatar had been like a flash in the pan, here today, gone tomorrow movie that was mildly popular for a few weeks and people weren't talking in earnest terms on CNN and NPR about the depression that people were feeling because Pandora wasn't a real place, and were people going to be committing suicide because they couldn't go there? And, you know, there was a while when it seemed as if Avatar was going to take over pop culture. Now, the weird thing is that didn't happen. It completely disappeared. It left no cultural footprint whatsoever.
Isn't that weird? Yeah.
You don't have little kids, you know, playing with Jake and Neytiri action figures. Mm-hmm. Most people who saw the movie probably couldn't remember the names of any of the characters.
Right. Actually, I can't remember any of the what the only name that sticks out from that movie is the word unobtainium, because
right.
It's
so weird, right? So, but whenever anything seems that culturally important, when it sucks up that much oxygen in the cultural conversation, then the culture warriors go after it. And I think it's just because – I think it's the same reason that, you know, if anybody – I don't know if anybody actually did commit suicide over Avatar, you know. But if
– Jeffrey Overstreet was tempted to that day.
If anyone did, I would say, you know, this was a fragile person who was looking for something to hitch their wagon to, and this is what came along.
Right.
If it hadn't been this, it would have been something else. It's not something intrinsic to Avatar.
Right.
But by the same token, I think this is what a lot of these culture warriors do with phenomena like that. Something big comes along and they hook their wagons to it. And in their case, the wagon happens to be, you know, Christianity is the answer and everything else is satanic.
Everything else is the problem. Yeah, yeah. And you do get that. And you get that sense that, well, you know, who was it? H.L. Mencken once remarked, his definition of Puritanism was the haunting fear that someone somewhere is happy. and so, you know, you go to a movie, you spend a couple of hours. That was fun. You know, this is an interesting world. And now it's over. But when it becomes a big thing, then, you know, this movie is bringing happiness to a lot of people. There must be something evil about it. And, you know, there are obviously there are flaws with them. I actually wrote an essay about Avatar one time, and I won't go into that right now. But the notion, yeah, that if it's popular, it must be evil. You know, you're going to get this. And we already have gotten this now with Doctor Strange. Thanks to Dr. Ted Baer.
Yes. The man who epitomizes everything that I went into faith-based film criticism in order not to do, and in order to provide an alternative to. I sometimes said that my mission in life as a Catholic film critic is twofold. On the one hand, I want to try to persuade people of faith that it can be okay to watch movies that came out after 1960 and R-rated movies other than The Passion of the Christ that aren't necessarily evil. And right. on the other hand, I also want to try to persuade film people who are completely secular that there are ways of engaging in film from a faith perspective other than counting inches of cleavage and swear words, and that it's you know, being religious is not necessarily just about being censorious. And then on top of that, I hope to try to show secular film people that, for instance, just because you consider The Last Temptation of Christ blasphemous doesn't mean that you're a censorious fundamentalist.
Right.
You know, and just because you find value in The Passion of the Christ doesn't mean that you're a fundamentalist anti-Semite.
Right. Right.
And then I want to turn around and say to the Christians, and just because someone says, you know, there are some problematic themes in The Passion of the Christ regarding the way that Jews are portrayed and regarding the violence, that doesn't make you an evil secularist.
Exactly right. We will be back with Deacon Stephen Cosby and the Tax Office and events in the film. Right after this, you're listening to Connecting the Dots and Mark Keene. We'll be back here on Red Box Media in just a bit.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello, and welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we're here today with Stephen Gridonis. And we are ready to take your phone call, by the way. If you're out there and you want to talk with us, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4BREAD-4, 1-573-4BREAD-4. And you can call us or text us at that number. You can also tweet us at Breadbox Media. So, Hacksaw Ridge.
Hacksaw Ridge. The latest movie from Mel Gibson, who has been absent from the cinematic scene for 10 years now, since Apocalypto in 2006. And it's a movie that clearly comes from the same man who made that film and The Passion of the Christ, and it has been formed by other films that he didn't direct, but that, you know, he was certainly crucial in, like We Were Soldiers. It's a World War II story, and it is, like many of his movies, an incredibly violent film, but it is a film that celebrates a man who was not himself incredibly violent. It's a fact-based story, and it tells the story of a man named Desmond Doss, who became the first American to – the first person to win the American Medal of Freedom in spite of being a conscientious objector. He was a soldier. He was a medic, and he served in a combat unit. But he not only wouldn't engage in violence, he refused even to touch a gun, even to pass basic training. And so this incurred for him institutional opposition from the military. He was almost court-martialed. And then, of course, there was also the hostility and suspicion of his fellow recruits who suspected him of being a coward and felt like, you know, he was not the guy who was going to protect them when the chips were down. But when the chips were really down on Okinawa, on a 350-foot escarpment that was nicknamed Hacksaw Ridge because the Japanese just held it so tenaciously and they chewed up American soldiers as they tried to climb over it and take it, this guy single-handedly saved scores of lives. The official he's officially credited with saving 75 lives single-handedly. He said it he couldn't have been more than 50. His superior said, no, it was more like 100, and so they compromised at 75.
Wow. And so that's amazing.
Tells the story, and it is. It's an amazing story.
Hmm. So the movie you were going to say, I'm sorry.
It's a film that, like many of Mel Gibson's films, there's a certain amount of conflict and tension in it, you know, because on the one hand, the movie is absolutely sincere in celebrating Doss's heroic nonviolence and his integrity and his commitment to these principles out of his religious belief, because Doss is a devout Christian. Now, the story, of course, is set in the 1940s, but even in the 1940s, he was unusually devout. You know, he was the kind of guy that got called Holy Roller and Holy Joe and so forth. Mm-hmm. He was a Seventh-day Adventist.
Okay.
And I don't know if Seventh-day Adventists are dogmatically pacifist, but his family seems to have been, and he was. But he still supported the war effort, and he wanted to sign up. And I think that Gibson is really awed by this man's integrity and by his ability in the heat of battle, in a situation that reduces most people to just sheer survival instinct and kill or be killed. And he didn't do that, and he kept his cool. And after all of the other soldiers who were still on their feet had retreated from the escarpment and gone down, he stayed. He stayed by himself, and went around rescuing people, running the risk of getting his head shot off by the Japanese at any moment. But at the same time, this is a film that also very much celebrates the more traditional military achievements of Desmond's fellow soldiers. So there is lots of war violence, and while it's horrifying, it's also undeniably, from a certain in a certain sense, it is celebrated, and so there is this conflict and this tension in the film.
Right, right. Well, and that's, I mean, there's just no denying that really, really gruesome violence is a constant theme, especially in Gibson's work.
Yes.
The guy has issues, you know.
Yes, clearly.
Go ahead. You're going
to
say something.
What I think he's trying to do is to channel those issues in a spiritual direction.
I do.
So, he's not trying to overcome them in the sense of making films that are about beatitude and civility and so forth, because that's not where he's at. But he's trying to make movies in which violence and this includes both inflicting violence, but also the capacity to endure violence, in which the capacity to endure violence is a trait that on the one hand is a defining characteristic of masculinity, but is also a way to a kind of spiritual purity.
Yeah.
And that's, I think his films are about the quest for spiritual purity. And that's why, in spite of the fact that, he does struggle with the implications of his beliefs. And at one point he gets angry and he's in a prison cell, a jail cell, and he just starts hammering with his fists on the door. But Doss comes off, whether you are a pacifist or not, and I think Mel Gibson is not, he comes off as incredibly admirable and heroic.
Mm-hmm. It was one of the things that struck me about The Passion of the Christ, which is, you know, I think that Roger Ebert was right. He said that The Passion of the Christ was the most violent film he had ever seen. And right in the middle, and it was a film that was completely suffused with a really deep understanding of the link between the Passion and the Eucharistic sacrifice and so on and so forth. And this is somebody who really has a Catholic imagination, there was a huge insight that seemed to elude so many people, in that this tormented man who makes this movie, everybody was focused on, admittedly, questionable at the very, very kindest suggestions about, Jewish involvement in the Passion and so on and so forth. But, right in the heart of that, at the moment that the nails are driven into the hands of Jesus, Gibson used his own hands to hold the hammer and the nail. And that tells you, I think, something very, very important about this guy, that he gets that, without Christ, he is totally screwed. I got to respect that, this is a man who, for all of his struggles, he recognizes that he is a sinner. And I remember reading an interview one time with him where he, remarked, he said, Caravaggio was an artist. He was a great artist. He said he was also a murderer, and a great sinner. And that comes out in his work. And so what you're describing in Hacksaw Ridge, that struggle between, violence and yet also respect for the sanctity, the real sanctity of that hero.
I think it's also interesting, and obviously this is just, it's baked into the material, but you do have a character in this movie who is part of something of a fringe sect, Seventh-day Adventism.
Sure.
I mean, yes, he's a Protestant, and America was at that time, to a lesser extent remains, predominantly Protestant. Mm-hmm. But he was a member of a Protestant sect that didn't even go to church on the same day as other Protestants, and that's right. Just weird.
Yeah.
So, and for someone like Gibson, who is a Catholic, but not your garden variety Catholic. He's a Catholic who is imaginatively and otherwise he occupies this world of radical traditionalism. Mm-hmm. And so he also belongs to a fringe sect in that sense.
Yeah.
I don't think, unlike his father, I don't think that Gibson is formally is schismatic. I don't think he's actually in schism, but his beliefs are effectively schismatic.
Yeah.
So, in both cases, so I think that he really relates to the idea of this hero who is an outcast, who's an outsider, who's misunderstood, who's misjudged, and who eventually, through the sheer force of his integrity, and also, I think it should be noted, his commitment to other people, he proves himself and he wins the respect of everyone around him.
Yeah. And I think that that's something, Gibson's, that's an issue for him as well. Of course, he's living in a community where he's really lost a lot of respect, and deservedly so, for some of his actions. But yeah, that hope for redemption is there. We will be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Granadas. We'll be back on Google right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Redbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello, and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. If you want to join us, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. You can also tweet us at Breadbox Media. I've been watching this series that was put out by Bishop Robert Barron, and I know that you've seen some of it too. It's called it's a follow-up to his Catholicism series.
Which, by the way, I just want to say, anybody listening, if you have not seen Catholicism, you need to check your parish library, check your local library. If your parish doesn't have it, give your rectory secretary hell.
It's great. It's really good.
Amazing. It's one of the most, I think, important media projects of the 21st century, and certainly for conveying and celebrating the faith. It is. It's just an absolutely astounding achievement.
It really is. It's amazing. It's beautifully photographed. It's so intelligently put together, and it amazes me the economy with which Bishop Barron is able to lay out. Really does a magnificent job of laying out the fullness of the faith. It's just so good. And this new series that follows Catholicism is called Catholicism: The Pivotal Players.
Which is such an interesting term, because you expect it to be a lineup of saints and doctors, and to an extent it is, but only to an extent.
Right. Yeah. Not everybody that's mentioned in it is a saint, for example. It features profiles of people that you would expect, like St. Thomas Aquinas,
or Francis of Assisi.
Yeah, you would expect Francis of Assisi to be covered and so on and so forth.
Catherine
but then
Siena.
He talks about Michelangelo.
Yes.
Not a saint, and in many ways, not a saintly man in some ways, But where would we be without him, without that contribution that he made to the faith? Or G.K. Chesterton, also
Chesterton,
not
indeed. And while he's a blessed, he's not yet a saint, blessed John Henry Newman.
Exactly. So his selection of figures, I think, is really interesting because he clearly gets, as many of us do not get, and frankly, as many ordained people don't get, that the church is not limited to priests or religious.
That's one place just for starters.
Yeah. I mentioned before, but I just want to make clear, this is Bishop Robert Barron talking. He is somebody who really appreciates the breadth of the faith and the breadth of the people of God. And so he brings in these figures that you wouldn't necessarily have started with,
And what he's doing here is really I think of a line from C.S. Lewis about how drearily similar all of the tyrants of history are, and how wonderfully different the saints are.
Yeah.
And in his Catholicism series, he examines the one truth of the faith from many different facets. He has a chapter on the mystery of God, and a chapter on Christ, and a chapter on the Virgin Mary, and a chapter on the Eucharist, and so forth.
Yeah.
But the mystery of Christ is unfolding in history. It's been unfolding now for 2,000 years, and it unfolds in the lives of men and women. And every person is here on this earth potentially with the vocation of expressing something about the truth of God and the truth of Christ, which only they can express. And
right.
In the flow of history, there have been these people, and one of these people articulated the theology behind it, who have helped not only to express but also to develop the riches of the faith, to bring to light what was hidden before, so that Christianity itself is appreciated in a new way. And the riches that were always there in the beginning are now more fully seen and appreciated.
And one of the things that I really love about Bishop Barron is, first of all, of course, he has real theological depth. He really he gets the faith in its depths. But there's more going on there, because, sure, he's been trained as a priest, and so you would expect, of course, that he would get that. But this is somebody also who has thought deeply about other things. So, for example, when he, in his video on Michelangelo, this is a guy who not only understands theology, but he gets the art of Michelangelo. And so he could talk you through what Michelangelo is doing in an intelligent way as somebody who just appreciates art.
Right. And put that in the context of the development of Christian thought. So, for instance, he'll show you how Michelangelo's paintings are rooted in classical scholastic theology and the theology of Thomas Aquinas, but then how that's applied in a Renaissance context and how, you know, the expanding cosmos and the larger intellectual world in which Michelangelo lived, you know, how he expresses these through his classical influences and the incarnation merged with the humanism of the ancient world.
Right. And he's not, and one of the things that he points out about Michelangelo is that although Michelangelo has, of course, great respect for the tradition, he is an artist. And that means, among other things, he's doing something really creative and new, things that people had never done before.
And that were controversial at the time, for sure.
Yes, they were controversial at the time. But one of the things which for some reason, had never registered on me before, one of the things that he points out is in the panel, he's talking about the Sistine Chapel and the scenes from Genesis and the scenes from creation.
Right. So it unfolds in these nine panels.
Right. And so when he's showing the scene of the creation of the heavens and the earth, in the creation of the heavens, you have the God is facing you and he's hurling the sun into being. Right next to that is also an image of God now creating the earth. And Michelangelo does something really startling, which it had never dawned on me. But if you look, if you pay attention, what he does is he paints God's bare bum. And it's like, can you do that? Right? Yes, he can. Why is he doing that? Well, his whole point, of course, is that when God is spoken of in the book of Exodus, particularly in his appearances to Moses, we are told explicitly that we are only allowed to see God's backside, as the sacred author calls it. And so this is done completely with reverence, and it's done with a very serious theological purpose, that our earthly encounter with God, we are always encountering God through a glass darkly. And so you don't see God's face when he's creating the earth. You only see his backside. And I was like, wow, you know. So I've been very impressed by these. I haven't seen them all yet. Have you had a chance to? What ones have you seen?
We have watched so far Michelangelo and Catherine of Siena. So
okay.
I'm really looking forward to Chesterton. No, we also watched Francis of Assisi. We did.
Well, you know, there is a canonical order to these things. You're supposed to start with The Magician's Nephew. Okay.
Have we talked about that?
Insidey joke. You know, I don't know if we've talked about that. The Magician's Nephew, for the listener, is the historically... In the chronology of the world of the Chronicles of Narnia, that's the story that technically happens first, because it happens first in history. The first book that was published was
The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And so there's this argument about which book you should start with. And,
well, and unfortunately, the argument has been subverted by the publishers, which at least since the early 90s and possibly going all the way back to 1980, they've renumbered the books and put them in quasi-chronological order. You can't entirely put them in chronological order because The Horse and His Boy is a midquel, as we say today. It actually takes place during the last chapter of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. But it's almost in chronological order. And that's – this is a terrible, terrible thing. Those of you who are Star Wars fans, you know – perhaps the horror of the suggestion that, you know, you should introduce your children to Star Wars by starting with episode one and taking them through to episode six. I mean, if you do that, then of course they know that Darth Vader is Anakin and no, Luke, I am your father is completely robbed of its power. And there are other problems as well with Star Wars, but with the Chronicles of Narnia, you know, in addition to other problems, as Lewis builds up his world, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is a story that's full of mystery. You don't know why this wardrobe gets you into this world and why there's a lamppost in the middle of a wood. And then in The Magician's Nephew, he answers these questions and you get this aha. Reading them the other way around, you get the answers before the questions and you're deprived of both of those pleasures.
Yeah. Well, we will come back and be discussing more of this fun stuff when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gridanis, and we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Your host, Mark Shea. And we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gridanis. And what else is going on in the wide world out there of media and culture? And
you know, I got nothing. We've talked about everything that I have to, because you know what it is? I haven't seen Trolls. Trolls is also opening in theaters this weekend, and I know I'm going to be getting. So, yeah, I don't know. I haven't seen it. But what I can tell you is that according to my friend Peter Chataway, of the three movies that are opening wide this weekend, there are two that have bare bums, just like the Sistine Chapel ceiling.
Okay, well then.
And there are two that feature decapitations.
Okay.
And Hacksaw Ridge is the one that has both of those things, as you are not surprised to find out. That's what we can talk about. I've seen Hacksaw Ridge now 1.5 times because after seeing it at a screening last week, I took Suzanne this week to the to the Fulton J. Sheen Center, Archbishop Fulton J. Sheen Center for Thought and Culture.
Okay.
In New York.
Okay.
That's where I tape Real Faith. That's where the magic of my 60-second reviews happen.
Okay.
And so Mel was there.
Okay.
And he was there with Robert Schenken, who is the screenwriter for Hacksaw Ridge.
Okay.
And my partner in crime, David DeCerto, did a Q&A with them before the screening, and after the screening, I had a chance to talk to Mel and to get a sense of where he was on topics like making films with faith themes and religious freedom, which is an important, you know, aspect of the film that I think makes it really relevant for today.
Okay.
So I can tell you that you already know that I really enjoyed the film. I've enjoyed many of the films that we've talked about in recent weeks. Doctor Strange, also big fan. Go see it in 3D.
Okay.
And The Birth of a Nation and Queen of Katwe, all these movies with very interesting faith themes. But Suzanne, I can also tell you, Suzanne really enjoyed Hacksaw Ridge.
Okay.
You know, Mel Gibson.
It doesn't sound like a date movie.
Well, you know, it's funny because on my feed, on Facebook, I'm getting very positive responses to the film, and some of them are from women readers. And,
oh, okay. You know,
there is something. This probably shouldn't be too much of a surprise. But really, really masculine things can be appealing to women.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. Well, I can imagine a lot of guys going, yeah, my girlfriend kept just burying her face in my chest. It was, that was nice. You know? But, yeah.
So, I can tell you, first, for one thing, that we got a couple of amusing anecdotes from Mel about the film. You can read a little bit about the evening at decentfilms.com. I put up an article about it, but I didn't put everything in the article. One of the things that I didn't put in was this story about going to Clint Eastwood in a panic the first time that he directed a film.
Okay.
And, of course, that was Braveheart, and was it Braveheart or was it The Man Without a Face? Which did he do first? I think it was Braveheart.
Okay.
So anyway, he calls Clint in a panic and he says, "Clint, I'm scared." And Clint says, "I know. You should be."
Thank you for your help. Well, I did okay with Braveheart, you know.
And he says to Clint, "What should I do?" And Clint said, "Just say action and cut."
Somehow I picture him, like, you know, wearing that that hat, you know, and chewing on a cigar while he says that. But the weird thing for me is that I was mentioning this. I think I mentioned this over the break. It's like, I have all these friends who, for various reasons, have all wound up at screenings with Mel Gibson, like serving them popcorn and, you know, talking to them afterwards. I keep thinking, how come I never get asked to a Mel Gibson screening? I sulk and feel bad, you know, pity myself for that. But
having said that, both when David was interviewing him and certainly when I was talking to him, you really saw that this was a guy who not only has had problems in the past, but is continuing to struggle today.
Right.
You know, the movie it's positioned as a kind of a comeback film for him. And people are talking in the media and then particularly in the entertainment media about, you know, is it time to forgive Mel Gibson? And, I think that it's worth pointing out that while he has this power to make movies that connect with a lot of people and that express important truths in a powerful way and that are also somewhat compromised by some of his obsessions and some of his but he's a man who in his private life, you know, he has been and to all intent and to all, you know, it seems to me that, you know, his demons are very much with him, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
well,
whether we accept him or whether we're willing to watch his movies and whether, you know, how much progress he's made on any kind of road to healing or to peace with himself or to peace with other people in his lives, you know, I can't begin to speak to that.
Yeah. Well, you know, you hope. I mean, that's the thing is,
you can't really know what's going on there, but it seems to me that for somebody who's, you know, makeup and gifts are very, very much tied up with the fact that he's an artist. You hope that through his art, God will work redemption. You know, that seems to be a huge part of who he is and how he's made and, you know, what he's built to do. And it's obvious that he is discharging those gifts. So you hope that as he is obedient in that sphere, grace moves out, you know, into other spheres in his life, and you hope the best for him, and you pray the best for him. But in the meantime, I think I will go and check out Hacksaw Ridge. I'm also really looking ahead. Did it say? I thought it said we were talking about this over the break. Arrival will be debuting. Is it next weekend?
Next weekend, yes. So hopefully, okay. I will see it. I'll make a screening this coming week, and okay. And we'll be talking about it a week from now.
I'm really, for some reason, I'm really intrigued by that film. I'm really looking forward to it. Partly, I mean,
I feel like I need to go back and watch Contact again.
Okay. I suspect that Contact is a very different movie, because it's Contact is asking very different kinds of questions. You know what struck me about Contact, though, for as aggressively atheist and secular as Carl Sagan was, Contact was a movie that was asking deeply religious questions, which is, of course, often the case with science fiction. Science fiction is kind of the last sphere in American popular culture where you can explore theology and get away with it.
I understand that there's actually more of that in the book than there was in the film. Some of the religious meaning in the book was left behind in the film.
That's interesting.
It is interesting, and it's particularly interesting when you compare a film that is in some ways a precedent to it, 2001: A Space Odyssey, where the reverse is the case. The book is much more secular, and the movie is much more mysterious and suggestive and open to transcendence.
Right. Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, golly, we could spend a whole hour just talking about this, but that habit of particularly of science fiction writers, and especially of atheistic science fiction writers, that obsession with theological themes that keeps coming back to people whose conscious philosophy is to push that all out of, get rid of it, you know, we don't need it anymore, really right. Fascinates me. It's a very, very interesting thing, and it just goes back to, for me, to the Chestertonian remark that, you know, when you get rid of God, you don't get nothing, you get anything. That need to fill that void is always going to be there, you know. But with Arrival, what interests me about Arrival is Arrival appears to be primarily a look at the mysteries of language and communication.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that Contact really is not. That's not primarily the focus. So I'm looking forward to that next week. I want to thank you. We're just about out of time here. We will return on Monday with Sherry Antonetti, who I think is probably just now coming down off of the high from the Chicago Cubs win. So we'll be back then. I want to thank you, Stephen Quinones, for being on our show today. Our producer today is Danny Head. And you've been listening to Connecting the Dots on Fox Media. Great weekend. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.